From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What's Tiny Tim of Tiptoe Through the Tulips fame doing singing a Led Zeppelin song? On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear selections from the new album Girl, a collaboration between Tiny Tim and our favorite avant polka band Brave Combo. Carl Finch of Brave Combo will tell us how they began working together and what took them so long to finish the project. And then we'll meet Tiny Tim, and he'll perform some favorite turn-of-the-century songs. And Maureen Carrigan reviews a new book about the folk revival called When We Were Good by Robert Cantwell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton is directly confronting Republican accusers with written answers to questions from the Senate Whitewater Committee. Mrs. Clinton's personal lawyer dismissed conclusions from the committee as a last-minute smear campaign. Mrs. Clinton's response came after committee Republicans leaked a draft of their final report. It accuses her of directing aides to keep hidden, sensitive documents removed from the late Vincent Foster's office. The draft also concludes senior White House aides tried to impede criminal Whitewater investigations to protect the president and the first lady. White House officials say the conclusions are not supported by the facts and are driven by election year politics. Meanwhile, jury selection is underway in Little Rock for the trial of two Arkansas bankers. Herbie Branscombe and Robert Hill face 11 felony charges stemming from the handling of funds during Bill Clinton's 1990 gubernatorial campaign. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
This is the second trial brought by the Whitewater Independent Counsel. The prosecutor's case has two parts. First, they allege that Herbie Branscombe and Robert Hill, both directors of the Perry County Bank, converted a little over $11,000 of the bank's money into campaign contributions to help re-elect Bill Clinton. The second part involves reports the two men should have made to the federal government when the Clinton campaign withdrew substantial amounts of money in the final days of the campaign. The Clinton aide who made the withdrawals has not been charged, but federal regulations require that transfers of over $10,000 be reported. The government charges Branscombe and Hill filed misleading reports to hide the transactions. President Clinton is not charged, but both he and a top-ranking White House aide are expected to testify in the trial. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Russia's prime minister says President Boris Yeltsin may offer Alexander Libed a government job. It's hoped the offer would seal Libed's support in the second round of presidential voting. Libed was the strong third-place finisher in yesterday's first round of voting. Neither Yeltsin or communist challenger Gennady Zyuganov won a majority, and a runoff election will be held next month. Libed already has begun sounding like a man being courted by both sides.
I will stand up to the trust given to me by millions of people. My main task is to prevent the country from returning to the quagmire of bloody chaos.
Alexander Libed. There are several end-of-term decisions from the Supreme Court. They include a decision to partly reinstate a Utah law restricting abortion. The 5-4 vote found an appellate court was wrong to strike down Utah's law after finding just one part of it unconstitutional. The ruling is a procedural one and doesn't deal with the substantive issue of abortion. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 6 points at 5,643. The Nasdaq is down more than a point at 1,212. This is NPR. Federal arson investigators are on the scenes of two new church fires in the South. The Hills Chapel Missionary Baptist Church in Rocky Point, North Carolina, is a predominantly black church. It was burned overnight. And the former sanctuary of the multiracial Pine Lake Baptist Church near Atlanta was also damaged by fire. A wave of fires at mostly black and multiracial churches has struck the South. There is increasing worry there is a campaign of racially motivated violence occurring. Attorney General Janet Reno says the fires clearly seem racially motivated, but that it's too soon to tell if there is a specific pattern. A new report says America's school children score well against those in other countries when it comes to reading skills. Dave Mattingly reports.
The National Center for Education Statistics examined a 1992 study that measured the reading skills of school children in 32 countries, specifically reading comprehension among fourth and ninth graders. The result, school children in the U.S. ranked second only to Finland on a consistent basis. The report says American fourth graders trailed only their counterparts in Finland and Sweden in reading comprehension. Among ninth graders, the U.S. again lagged behind Finland, but scored about the same as students from 15 other countries. Overall, the report says the reading skills of American school kids are better than the international average. That's except for black children and those whose mother and father lack high school diplomas. It also concludes the higher the education level and income of the parent, the higher the reading skills of the child. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Fire crews in Utah are closer to containing a giant brush fire that's threatened a major power substation that feeds electricity to Las Vegas and the West Coast. Firefighters hope to contain the blaze later today, but winds, measured at 40 miles per hour, could make that hard. The fire has charred more than 3,200 acres just south of Salt Lake City. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from William Morrow, publisher of Kenneth C. Davis's new book, Don't Know Much About the Civil War, Everything You Need to Know About America's Greatest Conflict But Never Learned. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You're about to hear the results of a most unusual collaboration between Tiny Tim and Brave Combo. And you'll probably never think of Tiny Tim in quite the same way again. Most people who remember Tiny Tim write him off as an eccentric one-hit wonder. The hit was Tiptoe Through the Tulips, which he warbled in his falsetto, accompanying himself on ukulele. In the late 60s, he performed turn-of-the-century pop tunes on the TV series Laugh-In and married the woman he called Miss Vicky on The Tonight Show. This new album on Rounder Records teams him up with Brave Combo, the Texas-based band that originated New Wave Polkas. They've played loving but hilarious parodies of all sorts of rock, including transforming The Doors' People Are Strange into a polka. And they play straight versions of all forms of American regional music. Later we'll meet Tiny Tim. First we'll hear from Carl Finch, the leader and pianist of Brave Combo. From their collaboration called Girl, this is the Led Zeppelin song Stairway to Heaven.
There's a lady who's sure all that glitters is gold, and she's buying a stairway to heaven. And when she gets there, she knows if the stars are closed, with a word she can get what she came for.
Whoa, 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 and she's buying a stairway to heaven.
There's a sign on the wall, but she wants to be sure. And you know sometimes words have two meanings. In a tree by the brook, there's a songbird who sings. Sometimes all of our thoughts are misgiven.
Whoa, 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 whoa. And she's buying a stairway to heaven.
There's a feeling I get.
Carl Finch, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
I think that this is a brilliant arrangement. It is a kind of cheesy and cheerful lounge arrangement for perhaps the most pretentious rock ballad in history. Electric piano, the the whole bit. How did you come up with this arrangement?
Well, actually, a co-producer on the project, James Big Bucks Burnett, is a massive Led Zeppelin fan and also knows Jimmy Page personally and thought it would be good to include this. And we ran it by Tiny, and he had no objections, so we decided to include it. And we had been playing this song as an instrumental lounge song for many years before we did the record with Tiny. So we kind of had an arrangement in mind and just kind of flew with that.
Now, has Jimmy Page heard it?
Oh, yeah, he's heard it, and he's, I don't remember, I think he said maybe this will finally put the lid on this song.
Even
something,
he wants
something
to kill it.
Like that.
Tiny Tim is so serious about his music. Do you think that he got the irony that you brought to some of the songs?
He may or may not have, but in a way, I don't think it really matters, because I think Tiny realizes on one hand that he is what he is, and he loves the old music and loves interpreting the old music and different crooners' styles. At the same time, he's always ready to poke fun at himself or to look at himself as a piece of promotion. I remember there was this Kenwood ad I saw where it was saying we can make everything sound good. And then there was a giant picture of Tiny's face, and it said, well, almost anything, I think implying that, well, we can't make Tiny Tim sound good, which, you know, most people would probably take offense at that. And we talked to him about it, and he said, oh, no, they paid me well.
Did Tiny Tim introduce you to songs you were unfamiliar with from the past that you've since really started to like a lot?
Oh, yeah, quite a few, and some of them are on the record. I love Sly Cigarette. I love All That I Want Is You, Springtime in the Rockies. You know, I think maybe I'd heard Springtime in the Rockies once, but we decided to do this a cappella thing with it, or more of a, not so much an a cappella, but kind of a barbershop quartet arrangement with just his ukulele. And these are three of my favorite songs right now. I really love Sly Cigarette. I'd like to figure out a way to expand that. And it's such an improper thing in these days and times to talk nicely about cigarettes.
Well, we're going to play a Sly Cigarette a little later when we hear from Tiny Tim.
Great.
So,
and a cool thing about Sly Cigarette, incidentally, is that we were trying to find more material that he was familiar with, and he carries around this giant book. It must have 1,000 songs in it at least. And we literally just thumbed through this thing, and that title just jumped out at us. So I feel like that within that book, man, there's like 100 more albums.
One of the tracks on the new record is called I Believe in Tomorrow, and it's an anthem about people helping people, poverty, a thing of the past, love for one another forever and ever to last. A very corny anthem, which is so much fun on the record. When he brought you the song and said he wanted to do it, what went through your mind?
The things you were just saying, for one thing, corny first, and, you know, who really believes this stuff? But through knowing Tiny, we've come to know a lot of other people. And this was written by a man named Bob Ponce, who writes this kind of stuff. All of his music is like this. And Tiny thinks he's one of the greatest songwriters of the 20th century. And he brought this song in particular in and said, this is a hit. It speaks to everybody. Everybody wants this. And so we thought, man, we've got to do it. And the first few arrangements we didn't like at all. Then we decided to do this a little more kind of a swing thing, which I thought worked really well. And Bob Ponce, incidentally, is thrilled that this is on the record and has sent many more songs for me to consider.
and are you going to?
There's so many people writing so many songs now that all sound the same. When something like this comes along, it at least stands out because, wow, nobody's writing this.
Oh, how true.
You know, in a way, that's the Brave Combo way. So,
and I like your hand claps.
Oh, okay. Well, good.
Yeah, very
our
inspiring.
Hand claps and our finger snaps, too.
Yeah. Okay, this is I Believe in Tomorrow, Brave Combo and Tiny Tim.
I believe in tomorrow, the day that all crime will end. The day all drugs disappear, all the world will be friends. I believe in tomorrow, the day that all wars will cease, the day all nations will know they can all live in peace. I believe in tomorrow, the day equality reigns, the day all races and creeds get along without pain. People helping people, poverty a thing of the past, love for one another, forever and ever to last. I believe in tomorrow.
Music from the new Brave Combo Tiny Tim collaboration called Girl. And my guest, Carl Finch, is the pianist and leader of Brave Combo. Now, how did you get to record with Tiny Tim?
James Burnett was bringing him to town, had brought him to town a couple of times before to Dallas. That's the town I'm talking about. And on the third trip, he thought that we should maybe try to do a show with him. And he was going to be here for a few days and thought maybe we should go into the studio. So we thought about it, and we had the time, and we did the show, and it went really well. So we went to the studio and cut the first few songs. And the first time in the studio, we got some great things and got some pretty lame things, things that you'll never hear.
But maybe you'll describe them.
Well, Tiny came in and wanted to do, initially he wanted to do a tribute to Michael Jackson, and we just didn't want to do that. So then he said, let's do a tribute to the Beatles, and we thought, well, we'll do some Beatles songs and see how that goes. And we did several, and we saved a couple. We saved Hey Jude and Girl from that session. And then we wanted to steer him toward music that he was really familiar with, that we thought we could update and, you know, make more palatable to the modern ears.
Now, the liner notes to your new CD with Tiny Tim explained that there was some kind of Mr. Ed Festival that initially brought Tiny Tim to town. What is the Mr. Ed Festival, and what's the connection between Mr. Ed, Tiny Tim, and you?
Well, once again, James Burnett, Big Bucks, as his friends call him, is also, he's the president of the Tiny Tim fan club. He's also the president of the Mr. Ed fan club. Somewhere, he sees these things coming together, and he put on a festival called Edstock many years ago, and I don't think he'll mind me telling you this, but he lost several thousand dollars on this. Tiny Tim was one of the featured performers, and so throughout the years, Tiny has somewhat been repaying debt to Mr. Burnett. Anyway, the connection is just that James Burnett has this feeling, this strong feeling for both, and in fact, he got Tiny to record one time the Mr. Ed theme song for a 45.
Oh, I'd like to hear that. This album took a long time. You started it in 1988 and ended it pretty recently. What took so long?
Man, don't you feel like the years are just flying yourself? I mean, gosh, I don't know. I mean, I kind of know. I remember every second. We met him a long time ago. His schedule's really busy. That's one thing that people should understand about Tiny Tim is he's a busy man. He works constantly. He does concerts, fairs, openings of supermarkets, just anything, commercials. He's on Howard Stern pretty regularly. He's really follows the media trends very well. But he was busy and we were busy and we got together and didn't like the album that we produced at that point as a whole. We felt like it was way too novelty oriented. So we wanted to get back together, and it took about a year to get our schedules together. Then we wanted to do it again. It took about a year. And then Tiny and Big Bucks had a falling out for about 3 years, and that's a big hunk of time when you're trying to finish a record. So they patched things up, and we got back to work, and then it took about a year to get it mixed and mastered. And so, man, you know, it seems like yesterday, but my life just feels like that now. 8 years doesn't seem like any time at all anymore.
Now, didn't Tiny Tim have a falling out with the producer of your record because he was in love with a friend of the producer's who didn't love him back, and he couldn't bear to work on the record anymore?
Man, that's a vague story, isn't it? Well, the story is that, once again, Mr. Burnett, Big Bucks Burnett, was the co-producer on the project with Brave Combo, and he introduced Tiny to Miss Stephanie. I think it was on the second trip to Dallas. And she had a ukulele and wanted him to give her some pointers. And, man, it's like, gosh, what was the term? All the cuckoo clocks in his clock went, oh, I don't know, forget that. But anyway, he flipped out over her, thought she was the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen. And Tiny loves the women, you know, he really does. Women make life worth living to him. And he has many stories about relationships over the years, and Stephanie was the most beautiful woman he'd seen at the time, and he flipped, and it didn't work out, so he couldn't bear to be around a Big Bucks or Brave Combo anymore because we reminded him of Miss Stephanie, so that was the reason we didn't get together for 3 years.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me now. I mean, because I lived through it, but it was very strange. There's so many stories. There are so many stories, like the time that, in all seriousness, he just looked at me and said, Mr. Finch, did I ever tell you that I ate a box of Rice-A-Roni without cooking it one time?
and
you know, we were right. Man, you know, I was at the board mixing at that moment. He just, where did that come from? Oh, geez. You know, he's such an interesting guy. I mean, they need to do a made-for-TV movie someday.
My guest is Carl Finch, the leader and pianist of the band Brave Combo. Their new CD with Tiny Tim is called Girl. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Carl Finch of the band Brave Combo. They have a new CD with singer Tiny Tim. Tiny Tim is kind of obsessive about washing. did that ever interfere with a session?
Sure, yeah. I mean, we had to totally stop, and he had to go to the motel a few times.
To shower or bathe?
Yeah, if he had to take care of something, he'd go home and totally clean up and come back fresh. So, you know, I don't know how explicit to get, but...
I guess that's enough.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there were a lot of things we had to do according to his terms. One time he wanted a Coke, you know, and so someone went out to get him a Coke and came back and it was a fountain Coke and hands it to him and goes, oh, no, this won't do. Must be a canned Coke. So I had to call my wife at home. I mean, we're like tapes rolling practically. We got to get on with this. So she had to run a canned Coke over, and he said, oh, that's much better. And he talked for a while about the tiny bubbles in the canned Coke, how important those are.
Was it frustrating or amusing to work with somebody so unusual?
There were times it was really frustrating. One of the few moments I've ever literally run out of the studio screaming because of doing things over and over. Mostly, though, I remember it very fondly, and the good stories, which I can, you know, like one time, he didn't want to fly home one time. He lived in New York, and he wanted to take the bus, and we begged him, don't take the bus. Please, fly. You know, we had money for the tickets. He, at that moment, you know, his value structure kind of shifts around sometimes when it comes to stuff like that, and he wanted to take the Greyhound from Denton. The first stop an hour later is Dallas, and he's on the bus for 4 days. You know, I mean, just imagine this, on a Greyhound bus, Tiny Tim with his, I'm not kidding, with his ukulele sticking out of a paper bag, and he's 4 days on the Greyhound from New York City. We were worried to death, you know, and we finally reached him 4 days later. Oh, yes, well, I made it fine, and all right, whatever.
Oh, great.
So, you know, you don't really judge him by anybody else's rules. And as soon as you realize that and you go into it and realize that you're dealing with Tiny Tim, everything goes pretty well.
Do you have any musician friends who said, you're crazy to do an album with Tiny Tim?
Oh, yeah. Dozens. You know, everybody's been confused by this. And I've been really, really pleased that the response has been as good as it's been, because we were pretty concerned. We wanted this to be a Tiny Tim record and for people to view us as friends in a more supportive position. And I'm really glad that it's worked out the way it has. You know, I would love it if something from this would actually become a hit. That seems remote, but it's possible.
What would you tell your musician friends when they expressed their skepticism?
Well, I think that just, you know, a lot of people just don't know the depth of Tiny Tim, and a lot of people just think of him as somebody that was on a Laugh-In or got married on The Tonight Show, and they don't really know much more about him. You know, he's been viewed as a sideshow freak for so long that I think it's time for us to look at the treasure that he really is. And, you know, one cool thing about him is when he sings in these different voices, and his falsetto actually is not his main voice anymore, he really is imitating different crooners that influenced him over the years, and he can do like a very good Russ Colombo, for instance. You know, like he nails that guy's style, and who else is going to do that? You know, who else is even going to know much about his music except some archivist stuck in some library? You know, he can bring this music out to the public in an entertaining way, and I think that's really special.
Are there any songs that you play on your new record with Tiny Tim that are going to be permanent parts of the Brave Combo repertoire now?
Well, we play our own arrangement of Sly Cigarette now, and have, as I mentioned before, we've been playing a swing lounge version of Stairway to Heaven for some time. I'd really love to do All That I Want Is You. Hey Jude Cha-Cha was our arrangement before we met him, and we just had him sing it. And we end the song even without Tiny with la 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 cha cha cha. You know, we leave the Hey Jude totally out at the end because the dance is what's important at that point. Yeah, I imagine we'll be doing half these songs eventually, and we're doing some shows with him at some festivals coming up. So he's coming to Texas to rehearse, and we're going to basically learn the album all together.
One of my favorite and one of the strangest, I think, tracks on the new CD is the title track, Girl, mm-hmm. and it's the Lennon-McCartney song. Mm-hmm. Now, I know you chose a couple of Beatles songs for this. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the arrangement. It's just like putting this song together with Tiny Tim.
We worked on it a couple of different ways, and I always liked the song because I felt like it had kind of a melancholy feel to it, and we wanted to take it in a little more sinister direction because Tiny is pretty verbal about his relationships with women and his feelings, and if you really start talking to him, he'll bring in all of these things that have influenced how he feels about women. So we thought, you know, we can maybe give it a little more of a sinister edge and give him a chance to talk a little bit at the end. And I think that that's the most revealing aspect to it, you know, is whoever he's thinking about here must have done him wrong, I guess.
Well, before we hear Girl on the new Brave Combo Tiny Tim CD, Carl Finch, let me thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
And Carl Finch is the founder, pianist, and leader of Brave Combo. And in a moment, we'll hear from Tiny Tim himself. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air, and this is the title track of the new CD, Girl.
Is there anybody there? Anybody there?
Is there anybody gonna listen to my story all about a girl who came to stay? She's the kind of girl you want so much makes you sorry, still you don't regret a single day.
Oh, girl, girl, girl. Oh, girl, girl.
When I think of all the times I tried so hard to leave her, she will turn to me and start to cry. And she promises the earth to me, and I will leave her. After all this time, I don't know why.
Girl, girl, girl. Oh, girl, girl, girl.
She's the kind of girl that puts you down. When friends are there, you feel a fool. When you say she's looking good, she acts as if she's understood. It's cool.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Tiny Tim discusses his voice, his persona, and the songs that helped him recover from a broken heart. He'll also perform some favorite songs from the turn of the century. And Maureen Carrigan reviews When We Were Good by Robert Cantwell about the folk revival.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Well, we've heard Carl Finch's story about how his band Brave Combo ended up collaborating with Tiny Tim. Let's meet Tiny Tim himself. It's been over 25 years since he was a big commercial success. His hit, Tiptoe Through the Tulips, made it into the top 20 in 1968. And in 69, when he married the woman he called Miss Vicky on The Tonight Show, it had one of the biggest audiences in TV history. Tiny Tim, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good afternoon, it's Terry Gross. It's glad to speak to you and your wonderful show.
Do you call everybody Miss, by the way?
Yes, I call my wife Miss Sue.
How come?
Well, I do that. It's more formal. I don't want to take no one's name for granted. If I never even meet the person, I don't want to call them by their first name. It's not etiquette, and it keeps me in a very adequate sort of proper way.
Even with your wife?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't want to take no name for granted. I don't even like, frankly, if you want to know, I like to have, when nothing is happening, my pajamas on all the way. I don't like no one to see my body when there's no need for it.
Should I call you Mr. Tim?
If you want, you can call me Tiny, too. Whatever feels good to you.
Now, let me play a song from the new CD that's more in your period. More, I guess this is a turn-of-the-century song. And it's called Sly Cigarette. Tell me about this song, how you found it.
That was my darling wife, Miss Sue's favorite. The song was sung in 1898 by S.H. Dudley, one of the great cylinder stars of his day. I got this in a collection of cassette tapes from Mr. Doolittle, a great historian who passed away a few years ago in Florida. And I thought the song was another great melody and also a message song. Even though it was 1898, it was a shock to see a woman smoking.
Let's hear Sly Cigarette. And this is Tiny Tim from his new album, Girl.
Oh, you poor little cigarette. How they're stomping and crushing you today. They're taking advantage of your small little nature. They're blaming you for cancer when you can still get cholesterol from butter and fat from lard and bacon and all these meats and cheeses that are causing heart attacks and tumors. Why are they picking on you, oh sly cigarette? It's not fair. Somebody has to protest and get back to normality again. When I have to pretend that I don't, you know. Oh, sly cigarette, yes. Oh, fine cigarette, what is it? Why did you teach me to love you so? When I have to pretend that I don't, you know.
And my guest is Tiny Tim. So tell me, do you sing in a falsetto anymore?
Yes, right now, it's in the afternoon. This needs a lot of warm-up. I'll just see if I can even do a poor version of... Oh, tiptoe through the tulips with me.
And how did you discover your falsetto voice?
Well, I thank Jesus Christ for every gift because I really prayed about it one day. And about 1952, I needed something... to differentiate myself from better singers at the time, especially from Tony Bennett, Perry Como, Guy Mitchell. And so every entertainer, every artist, every comedian, every broadcaster should have a sound, an originality in the voice that the mass can identify with singly. And so originality is the key to success. You can close your eyes and know it's Louis Armstrong, know it's Bing Crosby, and the same thing, you know, it's Tiny Tim if I do tiptoe, whatever. And so that's what I looked for. That's what I got. And from 54 on, it proved to be successful.
Now, back in the 50s, before you were famous, how did you dress when you performed?
Well, another good question. Well, I had a usual shirt and tie and suit jacket. I didn't start wearing costumes until... 68, 69, and Mr. Sharp in Australia made me unbelievable costumes after that. But When you went to amateur nights, you always had a suit and tie on.
Short hair?
Yeah, until 54. Then everything changed. Not only did the hair become long, which I took a little bit from Rudolph Valentino. Mr. Valentino, in his book that he wrote in 1923, and he had his hair parted one way over the eyebrow. I wanted mine the other way. And the only difference is that why long hair was here since day one, the difference here is that I had white-faced makeup with it throughout the day, not just for show business. And the white-faced, whatever Jolson did to blackface, it happened here with white-face and the long hair. So that in 1954 and 55 and 56, in the years that President Eisenhower was here and the McCarthy hearings were ending, I mean, that was a rough thing to look at 24 hours a day.
You said you were wearing the white makeup not just for show business. What were the other reasons?
Another good question, Ms. Gross. First of all, since I was not good-looking and I didn't want to cut this nose off, I was afraid of operations, I've always wanted to appeal to certain type of women I liked. Everyone has their dreams of what they want. And, of course, the hair was too short. So when I wore the makeup, I should also state that I still cleanse today about 8 to 12 times a day and use night creams and eye creams and throat creams and, of course, light makeup. But at that time, I wanted to also appeal to the women, even if they said, oh, I can't stand them. Look at that ugly thing in the subway trains. At least they were paying attention. So part of it was for show business, and part of it was to live within myself and be content. And it started to work on both fronts. On the amateur nights, I was starting to win under Larry Love in the 50s, and in the subway trains around the neighborhood, they were all looking. And the high voice also became, believe it or not, appealing to especially the girls who listened to me. Whether it was funny or grotesque, it still was appealing. At least they paid attention. And so that's the difference.
Excuse this cheap bit of psychoanalysis.
Go right ahead.
But it seems to me, in a way, what you're saying is that you felt unattractive, you felt like a freak, and so to transcend that, you kind of turned yourself into a freak by putting on makeup and growing your hair long.
Well, I was unattractive. I didn't think I was. I was a very ugly person when it came to looks.
Mm-hmm.
They looked at it as a freak, you know, with the white makeup. And mm-hmm. The world mm-hmm. looked at it that way. The world looked at the hair like that, and especially in the 50s, the middle 50s. But inside one's heart, I felt that I was especially wearing white makeup, not dark makeup, because white seemed, I've always looked at the princesses that I adored in my dreams to be equal with the white light, beautiful springtime. And I wanted to feel within me, with the songs and everything, that I had a sensuality with the women I liked. I don't know if I can explain it that way. And by wearing this light makeup, I felt even with myself by keeping clean. I've always looked at women as clean objects who wash their hands all the time with soap, who take care of their bodies and never offend.
So the white makeup gave you a sense of purity and cleanliness.
Beautifully put. Beautifully analyzed, yes.
Do you still wear it?
Well, it's not as white as it is, but it's whitish today.
My guest is Tiny Tim. His new CD with Brave Combo is called Girl. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tiny Tim. Your big breakthrough in terms of celebrity was your recording of Tiptoe Through the Tulips.
Yes.
In fact, why don't we hear a little bit of it?
Tiptoe through the window, by the window, that is where I'll be. Come tiptoe through the tulips with me. Three.
How did you make this recording of Tiptoe Through the Tulips?
Well, that's a good question. Well, first I was discovered in 1967 in August in New York City at Steve Paul's Scene, a little cabaret club on 46 near 8th Avenue down in the cellar. I was discovered by Mo Austin, who was then the vice president of Reprise Records, Mr. Sinatra's company, and it came to Mr. Austin's attention. He came down to see me play a few songs on the ukulele, and then said, would you like to sign a contract with Reprise? That same night in August of 67, I said, sure. And they brought me out to Hollywood in November of 67, recorded the album in January of 68, and it was produced by Richard Perry, who was nobody at that time. And, of course, he came on to have many more hits, like To All the Girls I Loved Before, You're So Vain by Carly Simon. But I was the first big hit he had with Tiptoe Through the Tulips.
And Tiptoe Through the Tulips led to your appearances on Johnny Carson and Laughing.
Oh, it sure did. Not Laughing. Laughing came before the recording came out. Laughing, ironically, you know, When It Rains, It Pours. But When It Rains, It Pours, and while I was in Hollywood getting ready to do the record, word was brought that I was there, and they wanted to know if I'd audition for Rowan and Martin. I said, sure. That was in 67 of December. So I went there, and the Rowan and Martin audition, George Slaughter was there, the big producer, and Fred Friendly. This was the only audition I ever made. I must have failed tons and tons of auditions, going back to 42, when I couldn't even make Ted Mack's Amateur Hour. I must have tried seven times. And that's the only audition I ever made was the big one for the Laughing. That's why to all your listeners, you know, thank Christ, I just say that never quit, never lose. I mean, you go down to the end, you do your best and pray for the rest.
You know, I think in the business you're seen as a novelty act. Is that how you would like to be seen?
Maybe not. But if it's so, fine, because I wanted to make it. And I prayed, of course, the right way. And if that's the cross I have to bear, fine. In fact, I want to emphasize, in case many articles say, I'm not trying to change by doing this album. I like the songs, whatever's top 10. I have a heavy metal record in Sydney, Australia, with Highway to Hell, which I did in 1993, which never even came out to this country yet. I've done the song because I like the song. Youth makes all music. Youth made ragtime in 1910 when they were saying, bring back the old songs then, like I Love You Truly, and youth made jazz in the 20s, right after World War I, and the boogie-woogie in the 40s, you know, and the rock and roll in the 50s after the blacks originally did it. So I'm telling you, so youth makes their own music. So when I see these old-timers say, oh, what disgusting music it is, they haven't heard it. The rap and the beats and the soul are the music of this generation, and one has to be born again into these songs. That when I did Highway to Hell, just a snip of a... I'm on the highway to hell, living easy, living free, season ticket on a one-way ride. No, and that's with a heavy metal band. So definitely one must take and be born again into this new music today. Just, if I may do one more for you.
Oh, please.
Miss Terry? Yeah, this is now we just left Decoration Day. And there was another great song, ironically sung by Henry Burr, for the great veterans who died on Decoration Day, to remember them. In 1917, this great song. At a grand old meeting on Decoration Day, I heard a veteran proudly say, what makes us love this country, land of the brave and free? I'll tell you what, said he, it's liberty. L stands for love of our country, I for independence too, B for the brave men who fought for us, E the emblem dear at white and blue, R for the right that we fight for, T true Americans will be, Y is for you and for your country too, that stands for liberty.
You certainly put your heart and soul into songs when you sing them.
Oh, listen, there are great romantic songs going back, you know, especially from 1848 and Stephen Foster's time to about 45. The great melodies in the gramophone years, so many like that, which I have listened to and which have consoled me in this business. It wasn't the loss of fame or never seeing the cash that got me. It was the broken hearts that I've suffered many years over romances due to my excitabilities or my simplicities that were broken up, and I couldn't get them back together again. You're so patient, Miss Terry. Just let me do one more number from that period that I sing many times when I think about some women I've hurt with too much of a hasty argument, and I've never seen them again. This was written in 1916 by the late, great Ernest R. Ball and J. Karen Brennan, who wrote When Irish Eyes Are Smiling and Mother McCree, also sung by Harry McDonough, great star. Just a snip, and thanks for your patience. Turn back the universe and bring me yesterday. Turn back the hands of time that hold life's golden ray. Take back that bitter hour when our love passed away. Turn back the universe and give me yesterday. Many a time I was singing, take back that bitter hour when our love passed away. I have experienced that many times in romances, and I've experienced that in 1985. I was working with the circus then, third-rate circus, Alan C. Hill Circus, going from town to town. And I came to a place in New Jersey where I worked, and or Pennsylvania, and they allowed me a night off to, right after the circus, to go to a new disco opening up in New York called the Palladium. There was a beautiful girl, Miss Lauren, there. She was I was so much in love with her. She was only 19 years old, and she liked me very much. I'll never forget that great night. But a few years later, about 88 or 89, I had some argument with her, and even though she's had arguments with other people, it was a shock coming out of this mouth, and nothing was the same after that. That's one incident. I wish I could take back that bitter hour when our love passed away. And to all your listeners, it is true. One word, one gesture can break up a romance.
You know, everybody's getting rid of their turntables and putting in CD players instead. I bet you still have a lot of 78s, right?
Not anymore, but I tell you, since you brought this up, I am the only, if I may say, celebrity entertainer who has at least one or two cylinders in the Edison Museum in Bellard, Illinois, since 1977, if it's still there. At that time, I recorded with my late conductor on the piano, Marvin Lewis, two Edison cylinders from the machine. They were nice out there to cut, you know, they shave off the old cylinders for 2 minutes to sing some of the great, one or two great songs of 1904, and this is how I sounded through the cylinder horn.
Nothing to do, Nelly darling, nothing to do, you say. Let's take a trip down memory ship, back to the bygone days, back to the old village schoolhouse, back to the dear days of yore. Let's take a trip down memory ship, let us go there once more. School days, dear old golden rule days, reading and writing and arithmetic, taught to the tune of a hickory stick. You are my queen in calico, I was your bashful barefoot beau, and you wrote on my slate, I love you, Joe, when we were a couple of kids.
Tiny Tim, and what other performer would want to sound like that were really recorded in 1904, and what other performer would know the verse to School Days?
Well, a lot. Well, remember that great song written by Gus Edwards, In This Country, was the biggest cylinder record at its time. And when recorded on the old Columbia 78 at that time, which was only one side, it was worn out. And this whole world went to this great singer, Byron G. Harlan, and the song School Days, still played somewhere today, you know, in some place around the world. I mean, these are great melodies. I call this the white man's soul. I know you heard of the black man's soul with rhythm and blues and ragtime, but this is the white man's soul. These great melodies like You're a Grand Old Flag, like Yankee Doodle Dandy, School Days, In the Shade of the Old Apple Tree. They moved. They moved the hearts of men, women, children. It was not the words alone, but the music had a spiritual uplift. And that's what makes popular music, the, in my opinion, the root of all music.
Tiny Tim, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, Ms. Terry Gross, thanks for being a good listener, and it's a pleasure talking to you and your Fresh Air fun.
Tiny Tim has a new CD with the group Brave Combo on Rounder Records. It's called Girl.
Take it away, Tiny.
Hey, Jude, don't let her down. You have found her. Now go and get her. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better. So let her out and let it in. Hey, Jude, begin. You're waiting for someone to perform. And don't you know that it's just you? Hey, Jude, you'll do. The movement you need is on your shoulder. Hey, Jude, don't make it bad. Take the sad song and make it better. Remember to let it into your heart. Then you can start to make it better, better, better.
Coming up, a review of a new book about the folk revival. This is Fresh Air. For many older baby boomers, the advent of summer brings back memories of going away to camp, where they'd spend long evenings around the campfire singing folk songs like If I Had a Hammer and The Ballad of Tom Dooley. A new book about the folk revival, entitled When We Were Good, suggests that the happy campers of the late 50s and early 60s were being unwitting little subversives in their choice of music. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
On the season finale of The Simpsons, Homer went to a Lollapalooza-like rock and roll festival and felt his age. Homer wanted to twist and shout like he once did to the exuberant licks of the Beach Boys. Meanwhile, the depressed youth around him were zoning out to Cypress Hill and a mummified Peter Frampton. If the 40-ish Homer were just a few years older, the contrast between his uplifting musical memories and today's slacker melodies would have been even more dramatic. Had Homer come of age during the folk music revival of the late 1950s, he, like millions of other young, mostly white, mostly middle-class Americans, would have tried to find himself by warbling along to Goodnight Irene, Kumbaya, and other ballads about dispossessed Okies, railroad hobos, and black laborers like John Henry, the steel-driving man. Robert Cantwell did come of age during the folk music revival. In his new book, When We Were Good, Cantwell recalls going as a teenager to see Pete Seeger in concert. Seeger spread wide his arms as we sang to him, Cantwell says, and it changed me. That was 30 years ago. And I have not changed back. When We Were Good is Cantwell's attempt to understand why he and his conformist contemporaries in the 1950s were so drawn to folk music. His book is part cultural history, part biography, part confession. I wish I could tell you all these parts coalesced in a narrative as seamless as, say, On Top of Old Smokey, but it ain't so. Sometimes the music grinds to a halt altogether as Cantwell sketches out the history of the McCarthy era or the biographies of John and Alan Lomax. When We Were Good is a lot like one of those ballads that has a zillion stanzas. It can be tedious, but the overall story is so fascinating you tend to forgive the stretches of flat exposition. In the engrossing main line of his argument, Cantwell traces how, in the early decades of this century, folk music bolstered a nativist political agenda. Then, during the Great Depression, the labor movement and the left in general used folk music to promote a democratic vision of social justice. The Roosevelts, Cantwell notes, were great public supporters of folk music. And he includes a wonderful 1944 photo here of Eleanor Roosevelt grooving to Pete Seeger in the Washington Labor Canteen. After McCarthy and his minions purged allegedly Pinko songs like This Land Is Your Land from the airways, folk music went underground into a children's network of summer camps and grammar schools, where it was viewed as preaching a gentle message of brotherhood and love of country. It also represented a more authentic, purer image of America than the one offered by suburbia. The most interesting thing about the late 50s folk revival, Cantwell says, was not its political affiliations, but the lack of them. For we of the silent generation were good and wanted to be. As Cantwell vividly demonstrates, American folk music has risen from the dead many times during this century, always reappearing in new and varied ideological vestments. It emerged from its tepid 50s tenure with the likes of the Kingston Trio and Arthur Godfrey to help inspire the burgeoning civil rights and anti-war movements. Given that astonishing turnabout, When We Were Good encourages you to believe that even in this apathetic Alanis Morissette era, some weird kid somewhere with a banjo may be strumming Which Side Are You On? And stirring up some trouble.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed When We Were Good by Robert Cantwell. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Alan Tu, with Kathy Wolf and Louisa Shafia. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shirock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Additional support comes from Verve Records, presenting Now is the Hour, a new CD of romantic jazz moods from Charlie Hayden's Quartet West. Their website address is verveinteractive.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.